Okay, so last time we spoke about the Arab riots of 36 to 39, and from the perspective of why the riots occurred then, and what was the Jewish reaction with regard to changing the ideology of Zionism and in terms of the use of force, and could Zionism be achieved by peaceful means, or would you require, you know, aggressive action? And there were issues of purity of arms, how aggressive can you be in stamping out the enemy, collective responsibility of the Arab villages, and so on. Tonight I want to focus on the diplomatic and political consequence of the Arab riot. So, in October of 36, after unpleasantness had been going on for 6 months, the Arab kings in the neighboring states encouraged the Arab High Committee, which was the leader of the Palestinian movement, to call off their acts of violence and to end the strike, because people had been out of work for a half a year, to call off all of this, to allow for a royal commission to show up from London to investigate the situation. There had been many royal commissions beforehand. In the 1929 go-around, there was Hope Simpson, there was Shaw, there was a 21 commission, a 1920 commission. There had been many commissions over the years that produce a thick volume that usually gets ignored after the fact. But in the case of Peel, there was lasting significance because there was a new idea on the horizon, namely partition. So the commission comes to Palestine, and they take testimony from some Arab representatives, although some others boycotted, and from the Zionist leadership. They also took testimony in London, interestingly, because Jabotinsky, who was not allowed in the Land of Israel, was forced out after 1929 and not allowed back, he testified in London. What was the nature of Jewish testimony before this Royal Commission? So, basically, it's to emphasize that Zionism had peaceful motives, was not looking to cause trouble, and in fact the Jews are not causing trouble in this go-around, but it was begun by the Arabs, and they should pay the price. And to emphasize that Jews are in the Land of Israel by right and not on sufferance. The report issued by the Peel Commission would eventually accept that notion, that the Jews are there by right and not on sufferance. By what right? What right?
The Bible.
The Bible is our Kushan, is what David Ben-Gurion said. So Ben-Gurion, who typically did not cite the scriptures to Gentiles in reference to the legitimacy of Zionism, in this instance did exactly that. Emphasized not just the historic connection of the Jewish people to the Land of Israel, but the biblical connection, hoping that referencing the Bible would work in his favor with Bible-believing Christians. Does that work? Sometimes it does. You never know. So, the other consideration that the Jewish representatives wanted to stress was that the Zionists had built up the infrastructure of the country and improved the economy of the country such that the Arab population had not suffered materially on account of the arrival of Jews. And therefore, if your moral calculus was, is anyone getting hurt? Well, the answer is nobody's getting hurt. And so it's okay to continue fostering the growth of the Jewish national home. Remember, what the Jews have in mind here is that nothing should happen, that there should be no political outcome. Because no political outcome means what? The continuation of the mandate, and the continuation of the mandate means continued Jewish immigration, so that the balance of power continues to shift towards a Jewish majority over time, not right away, but you need more time. So no political outcome is the best scenario. The Arabs want exactly the opposite. They want an immediate political outcome, which would then nip in the bud for the Jewish immigration and the growth of the Jewish national home. So from the Arab perspective, their goal was to win over the British hearts by saying that we're the aggrieved party, that we had the dominant culture in this country as recently as just a decade or two ago, but that it's being stolen from underneath us by the arrival of these newcomers from Europe. Okay, so, you know, one of the questions that comes up is why, from an Arab point of view, is Zionism all the more problematic now in the late 30s as opposed to earlier. Not that the Arabs in Eretz Yisrael ever were pro-Zionist, but what is getting them all riled up now? So the answer is that, and this is something that they're able to tell the British, and some of the British buy into this line of reasoning, that Zionism was supposed to be like a boutique movement. How many Jews were really going to move to Palestine because of ideological fervor? Not too many. So you, the British, in 1917, could make promises to the Jews in Balfour that might not have injured us Arabs all that badly. I mean, after all, how many Jews are really going to move? As opposed to going to New York or, you know, elsewhere in the Western world. But what happened? Three things happened by the late 30s. They didn't all happen in the late 30s, but by the late 30s, all three had occurred. One, the United States closes its doors. In immigration legislation of 1917, 21, 24, okay, the U.S. doors are largely closed. Secondly, Nazism takes over in Germany, and so Western acculturated and assimilated Jews who had no relationship to Zionism all of a sudden are seeking a safe haven, and Palestine becomes that safe haven. And thirdly, the vast bulk of the Jewish world lives in Poland. You know, Poland is the center of the Jewish universe. And what happens? By the late 30s, it's an anti-Semitic regime. Their pogrom is every other week. So now the Polish Jews are itching to get out. If you combine all these factors, the closing of America, the opening up of the eyes of Western Jews to the advantages of Zionism as a form of salvation, and the fact that Polish Jews went out of Poland, and there are a whole bunch of them, 3 million of them, so now Zionism becomes a real movement with lots of people revolving through the door. And from an Arab point of view, this is no longer a little petty thorn in our side, but rather it's going to swallow us whole. This is the Arab argument, and some British politicians accept it for what it's worth, that it has tremendous merit, okay? And that maybe, in hindsight, because of all these developments, allowing for the development of a Jewish national home under British auspices was a historic mistake, a blunder, that can't be reversed, but at least it can be stopped short. Okay. So these are some of the arguments that are being made. Now we get to the suggestion of how to solve the problem. And with this, we'll spend the bulk of our evening tonight. What does the Peel Plan actually suggest? So it's published in July 7th, 1937, and it's most famous for its map. There are things other than the map that are important that we'll get to, but let's think about the map. I should have brought a copy of it, but if you look on your phones, you look Peel Plan, you go on Google Images, you'll see the map. What it does is, it takes British Mandate Palestine and divides it into three parts. There is an Arab part, a Jewish part, and a British part. The British part, which is ostensibly an international zone, but really just controlled by England, is the Jerusalem corridor. So what we today think of as Yerushalayim, Beit Lechem, everything going westward towards the Mediterranean Sea, up to Jaffa, okay? So that's going to be under British control, with the port of Jaffa being under international auspices, the port of Haifa also being a little enclave under international auspices, the Jews getting the whole Galilee, the coastal plain, part of the Jezreel Valley, and then south of Tel Aviv, south of Jaffa, another little piece that goes down towards Rehovot. So the Jewish state is like, you know, the vast bulk of it is one contiguous piece. Then you have the Jerusalem corridor cutting out to the sea, and then a piece that's Jewish south of that corridor in what is today like, you know, Beit Shemesh, Rehovot, Yavne, that area, south of Jaffa. What happens to the rest of the country? It's Arab. So what do the Arabs get? The whole West Bank, as we know it today, and the whole Negev. And the whole Negev, the overwhelming majority of the country goes to the Arabs. Okay, you got the map good. The vast bulk of the country is Arab. The slice at the top that goes down the coast is Jewish. And the peace in Jerusalem is international or British. Okay. It's nothing. It's nothing. Good, good, good. So because it's nothing, now you have a serious question. how will the various parties react to this proposal? So before I can get to the various parties' reactions, let's also think about some of the other factors. Another one is the exchange of population. Transfer. The idea here is that the Jewish state should be as Jewish as England is English and France is French. Well, you can only accomplish that if demographically you don't have a significant other population, but rather it's homogeneous. So in the Arab allotted area, there are almost no Jews, almost none. In the Jewish allotted area, there are 200,000, actually 220,000 Arabs. That's a lot, okay? So there are about 400,000 Jews, maybe even a little bit less, maybe 385,000 Jews, and 220,000 Arabs. That is not a good balance if you want to have a strong, solid, Jewishly Jewish state. How many Jews are in the Arab zone? 1,250. So we'll have an equitable transfer. We'll transfer the 1,200 Jews, and we'll transfer the 220,000 Arabs. How do you like that?
Wow.
Okay, so that actually is suggested by Peel's commission, and the British government nominally approves of it. How could this ever be carried out? So the Jews certainly couldn't effectuate it because they don't have the physical force to expel 200,000 people from their homes. Were the British going to do it? Unlikely. What was the precedent that was used to justify even proposing this scheme? So one precedent was the Turkish-Greek transfer after World War I, where you had Turks moving eastward and Greeks moving westward in large, large numbers. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people in order to accommodate ethnic tensions and to accommodate homogeneous states. So that's one example. There will be other examples.
Macedonia, yeah. For example, became
Right. So it works when you're dealing with roughly equal numbers and you're dealing with great military powers who are coercing it. But if no great power is coercing it and it's really lopsided, then it's unlikely to ever be put into effect. All right. That doesn't mean in the long run the transfer of population wouldn't actually occur. It would just have to wait another 11 years for the Israel's War of Independence. But at least in the late 30s, there was no way this was going to happen. Okay, so let's do the Arab reaction first, and then we'll go to the Jewish reaction.
Yeah.
Peel was just a British politician who I think was a member of the House of Lords, and actually he dies 2 months after his report is published. So he didn't live to see the end of the story. He just lived to see his report printed and disseminated and collapsed a little while later. Okay, so the Arab reaction was to say no, to reject this proposal. There was only one major Arab figure who favored this proposal, and I'll explain why, and that was Emir Abdullah of Transjordan, who would go on to become King Abdullah when Transjordan gets its independence in the mid-40s. So Abdullah is in favor of this for one very important reason, because I deceived you when discussing the map. It was not intended to be a Jewish state and an Arab state and a British zone. It was intended to be a Jewish state, a British zone, and a whole lot of territory with a lot of Arabs in it and almost no Jews granted to Transjordan. No new Arab state of Palestine was going to be established. So,
would be the state.
Well, you could argue that.
Because remember, Transjordan at one point was part of Palestine.
Correct.
That's what I mean.
So from the perspective of Cisjordanian as opposed to Transjordanian Arabs, if we want to use modern nomenclature, actually ancient nomenclature, this is not a good development because you want to have control over your own destiny. And if you're a politician or a politically inclined person living in Jericho, Jerusalem, Nablus, Jenin, whatever, you don't want to necessarily be under the authority of some Hashemite fellow from Arabia who was plopped into Transjordan by the British and made into an emir and a king I want my own sovereignty. I want to control my own affairs. I don't want to be just an adjunct to somebody else's country, even if we're all Arab.
I thought Jordanians don't want Palestinians in their midst.
Well, that's today. That's 80 years later. We're talking about in the late 30s. So the Arabs don't like this for a variety of reasons. Number one, they don't want any Jewish state whatsoever, even a small one in the Galilee and in the coastal plain. Secondly, they have specific objections to the territories that are allotted to the Jews. Aside from the fact that any territory was allotted, the specific territories are a problem. Now, why is that? So first of all, the Galilee is the Galil HaGoyim. That's the original name of the Galilee, the Galil HaGoyim, which means what? The province of the Goyim. The Galilee wasn't very Jewish. It wasn't Jewish in the first century. It wasn't Jewish in the 20th century. Okay? It was mostly Christian and some Muslim, but not very Jewish. And in fact, in 1947, when the United Nations does its partition plan, what happens to the Western Galilee? It's not given to the Jews. It's given to the Arabs. Why? Because it's mostly Arab. So why in the late 30s give it to the Jews? The answer is you got to give the Jews something. And it's the least populated area that is still cultivable, if that's a word, or arable, to use no pun intended. So therefore, you got to give the Jews something, give them that. But it was predominantly an Arab territory, not a Jewish one. Also, the lowlands of the coastal plain have the most fertile, has the most fertile soil. It's better than the stony soil of the Sumerian and Judean highlands. So although you have to give the Jews something, and the Jews are located mostly in the coastal plain, the Arabs can cry foul that the Jews are getting the better land. And as for the Negev, who wants the Negev? I mean, the truth is everybody wants the Negev. But you can complain, oh, it's not good compared to what the Jews were given. So that's a further complaint.
That's their natural habitat, isn't it? The Negev?
True, yes.
And the sand?
Yeah.
Actually, the Arabs could have made the argument the swap, because if you want to look at it biblically or historically, the Jews were not in the coast.
Right, the Philistines were. Right. Okay. So, and that is something that has long bothered the right-wing Zionists, that there's too much of a focus on Tel Aviv and not on the Yehuda and the Shomron. All right. Well, these are some of the Arab complaints. A further complaint was there was some talk, of not having a British zone in the Jerusalem corridor, but rather having a division of that corridor between Jewish and Arab regions, and giving the Jews a portion of Western Jerusalem. The Jews were insistent upon this, because what is in Jerusalem? Well, 70,000 Jews, number one, which is a significant bulk of the Yishuv. Also, the Jewish agency is located in Jerusalem. The Hebrew University is in Jerusalem. The holy places are in Jerusalem, but the holy places are a separate matter because they're holy to all faiths. But just even modern Zionist national institutions, many of them are located in Yerushalayim. So to not have that in the Jewish state was seen as a big problem. And so a theory was to divide the city in half. But the Arabs cried foul, if you divide the city in half, that's just the first step to the Jews getting the whole city and taking the holy places. That's another problem. Okay, so the Arabs got together at Bludan, in Syria, which is some little town 50 miles or 50 kilometers northwest of Damascus. And here there was a pan-Arab conference of Arabs from Lebanon, from Syria, from Saudi Arabia, from Palestine, from Jordan, even from Egypt and Tripolitania, okay, in which they get together. And aside from Abdullah supporting this proposal, everybody else says no, no, no. There shall be no partition of Palestine, but rather there shall be an Arab state or a democratic majority rule state as soon as the British are willing to throw in the towel. Okay. So that's the Arab reaction. Let's now go to... Very similar. Let's go to the Jewish reaction. So the right-wing reaction, And also among the centrists, and even among some of the leftists, this was true, and I'll explain why some leftists, but the right-wing reaction was to say this is a disgrace. This is the British reneging on the Balfour Declaration and abandoning the Jewish National Home Project and stabbing Zionism in the back. Unacceptable. Jabotinsky, who testified in London, said He gave a mushal, a famous mushal. All right? The mushal is the Titanic is sinking. And we have lifeboats. And there are 25 lifeboats. And what do? We voluntarily burn 24 of them. And save only one. And use it. What's the comparison? That if you take the overall British mandate for Palestine, which in its original borders included all of Transjordan, and you do the math, and you figure out what percentage of that overall territory was allotted by the Peel Commission report to the Jewish state, it comes out to about 4%. Now, it's not 4% of Western Palestine, it's significantly more than that, but it's 4% of the overall total. So it's basically saying it's burned 24 out of 25 of the lifeboats. Why the analogy of the lifeboats? Because Jabotinsky, more so than any of the other Zionist leaders, is already anticipating the Shoah. He sees world wars coming, and he anticipates that there will be a mass genocide of the Jews. He was an alarmist in that regard, at least in the eyes of everybody else, who didn't think this was going to happen. But in 1937, he's already talking along those lines.
He's living in Europe.
He was living part of the time in Europe, that's correct. And he was making trips to Poland, and he sees things are not good. So that's the right-wing reaction. There were some among the left who also were very much opposed to this plan. And these were people who believed in Eretz Yisrael HaShlema, a terminology that doesn't exist until 1967, 30 years later, but let's use the sort of anachronistically use the terminology because it's convenient. The whole land of Israel was something that was very meaningful to some of the kibbutz movement and HaShomer HaTzair. Some of the far left did not believe in partition. They didn't see that the solution to the Arab-Jewish problem wasn't dividing the land, but rather division is only bad, it's never good. Unity is good. Unity is good. Menachem Ussishkin, who was the head of the JNF purchasing, he also, terrible, very bad. No, partition is very, very bad. No good to partition. Who favored partition? So,
Ben-Gurion,
Chaim Weizmann, and Yitzhak Ben Zvi, and to a lesser extent Moshe Sharet. Why did Ben-Gurion and Weizmann favor partition? So there are a few reasons. Number one, the argument is that a small state is better than no state for the time being because it could function as a haven for the oppressed of Jews of Europe. That what is the world? The world is a bunch of interior ministries when you think about it. Interior ministries. The world is a big place, and you want to go from point A to point B, but there's a border. So how do I get across that border? I have to get a pass from this country's interior ministry saying that I can come in. I have a visa. So what is the world? The world is a bunch of interior ministries making decisions about who can move where and where and where. And if we have an interior ministry, we have a country that says that you can cross our border, and we actually control that border, then we could save a whole lot of people. Whereas if we have no state, and the British are in control, their colonial office decides who crosses the border, then we're all dead. Okay? So that's one very important argument. The counter argument, of course, to that specific point is, well, if it's too small, you can't accommodate the influx of hundreds of thousands or millions of people who are desperate for asylum. And that's very true. The Jewish state, if it was just the Galilee and the coastal plain, could have accommodated maybe 100,000 more, 200,000 more Jews in the short term, but not much more than that. Not millions and millions. Okay? It's too small. Another argument in favor of partition is that these borders are just the beginning. And that the Jewish state will have an expansionist agenda that will prove successful in the long run. This is 1937, Ben-Gurion talking. What really happens? Exactly that. In 1947, there's another partition plan, which is more favorable to the Jews, but the reality is that the 48 war gives better borders, and the Yom Kippur, the Six-Day War gives even better borders. So there's always more on the horizon until you have all of Eretz Yisrael.
That's dependent upon the fact that the Arabs don't want to accept it.
Well, that's taken for granted, number one. And number two, even if that wasn't the case, there's an argument to be made that David Ben-Gurion would have fomented conflict in order to achieve better borders. Now, this is not something that we like to talk about because it makes the Jews look bad and look like we're the militants and the land grabbers, as opposed to the Arabs being the cutthroats. So we can look back at the history as it happened, not as it could have happened. That's the way I look at it. Okay, so in 1937, there's the 20th Zionist Congress in Europe. I think it was in Zurich. And they have to decide, shall we accept the Peel Plan or not? There had not been as momentous a decision to be made since the Uganda decision in 1903. So 34 years later, the delegates to the World Zionist Congress have to make a real big decision for themselves. Do we accept the Peel Plan or do we reject the Peel Plan? On the one hand, Jewish statehood. On the other hand, it's too small. What do you do? So if it were up to you, what would you say?
Okay.
Take it. Okay, so in classic Jewish fashion, we'll have our cake and eat it too. The plan in its current format, in that particular map, was rejected, but the notion of partition was accepted as a basis for future negotiation. How do you like that? Well, it's better than the Arab approach, which is to reject. Meaning all you have to do is be only slightly more accommodationist than the other side, and you look like the good guy, and the other side looks like the bad guy.
Only a question of price.
Well, yeah. So the Arabs say, no, no, no. They look like they're totally obstinate and not willing to budge in the least. The Jews look more reasonable.
Yeah, but who's there to be impressed by?
The answer is the British administration.
Really?
In the hopes that a future plan would be more favorable towards the Jews.
Would you say that they were playing for time as well?
Yes, absolutely true, yeah.
Did the plan have a time frame in it as to when this would happen?
Yes.
What would happen with Jewish immigration before it was put?
So the intention was for a very rapid timetable. It was never absolutely decided what that timetable would be because the plan ultimately was rejected. We'll see in a minute how the Woodhead Commission mixes the whole thing. But the goal was not to have a long intermediate period of, let's say, 10 or 15 years like some other plans would have. The goal was to have it be sudden. Almost immediately, yeah. So another factor here for Ben-Gurion was the notion of transfer. Ben-Gurion liked the Peel Plan because it had the element of transfer. For the first time, there is talk of ridding Jewish parts of Eretz Yisrael of an undesirable population. And it's being spoken about not by the Jews in chauvinistic terms, but by neutral third parties, just as a matter of diplomacy, of realpolitik. What could be better than that? It's one thing, you know, it's bad if the Jews talk about it because then we look like we're looking to oust another population. We look inconsiderate and immoral. But if a third party says it, to our advantage, kol hakavod to them.
Isn't that what Kahana wanted to do?
Yes.
So it's not a new idea.
No, not a new idea at all. Okay. Because of the Peel Plan and because of the idea that transfer was an acceptable possibility in world affairs, this would impact the actions of the Haganah under the auspices of Defense Minister Ben-Gurion in 1948 in the course of the War of Independence. And we'll talk about that probably in about 2 months when we discuss the war. So if the plan was accepted sort of, in principle, if not in detail, now the question is, well, can there be implementation? One side, the Arab side, rejects it. The Jewish side nominally accepts it. What are the British going to do? In classic British fashion, they do what they always do. They appoint another committee, another commission, the Woodhead Commission. And the Woodhead Commission of 1938 is designed to figure out how practical or impractical partition might prove to be. In truth, the British had already decided this wasn't going to work. Because if one and a half sides don't want this, then there's no way it could be implemented. So the Woodhead Commission ostensibly was supposed to find a way to work to work with the Peel Plan and make it possible, but behind the scenes it was designed to kill the whole thing and to show in its concluding report that this cannot be done, we'll go back to the drawing board, which means British mandate continues for the foreseeable future. So that was 1938. But while that was happening, the Arab riots intensified and more Jews were getting killed. But who else was getting killed? A lot more Arabs. Thousands and thousands of Arabs were getting killed, probably about 5,000 total over the course of the riots. Why so many? That's a big question, and what were the long-term consequences of that? Why so many Arabs getting killed? Not really. I mean, the Jews did kill a few, but for the most part, the British are the ones doing the shooting. But why so many are dying? The answer is because, in part, there are many attacks and many people who are guilty of perpetrating those attacks and they get caught. But also, collective punishment of villages, when somebody runs away to an Arab village and the police know that they're here and they bludgeon the population until they find out who did it. The result of all this was that one-tenth of all adult male Arabs either died, were injured, imprisoned, or exiled during the Arab revolt. That one-tenth of all adult male Palestinian Arabs, something bad happened to them. Not all death, but either imprisonment or exile alike. This had a very detrimental impact upon their ability to field military-style units going forward. Whereas the Haganah, and later the Palmach, the Irgun and Lehi, are getting stronger and stronger, being trained and accumulating weapons, becoming a real force to be reckoned with to defend their population. The Arabs, as a result of being decimated, in the real sense, decimated, one-tenth, like in the Roman terms, could not field any real units throughout the 1940s. And going into the War of Independence in 47-48 did not have much of a fighting force to speak of. Okay. So, if the Woodhead Commission was going to kill the Peel Plan, then what's going to happen next? The answer is the British are going to pretend to have negotiations between the Jews and the Arabs, or between themselves and the Jews and between themselves and the Arabs, because Jews and Arabs can't sit at the same table because Arabs won't sit at the same table as Jews. Like right out of the Bible, where the Mitzrayim couldn't eat with Yosef and the brothers, okay, because Toivah Hila Mitzrayim. Well, they're going to gather at the St. James Conference in London in February of 1939. And at this conference, nothing will be accomplished. So why have a conference? Because the British have to always be seen as doing something to curtail the violence. Some diplomatic means of ending the bloodshed. But it fails. And because it fails, and the British have certain political interests, we're gearing up towards the White Paper of May of 39. So what's going on here? From a British point of view, they can take the Jews for granted. The Jews need the British more than the British need the Jews. The Jews need the British because without a colonial power holding the bayonets and running the country and allowing Jews into the country, there would be no Jewish national home developing. There'd be no Jewish immigration. So if the Jews don't have the British, they're finished. Their goose is cooked. That's it. They can't complain. But the Arabs, they can always cause more trouble. And even though the riots have been suppressed, the riots could always flare up again. What can the British do to lessen the tensions? Well, they can give in to Arab political demands. But of the various Arab political demands, which ones are the most likely to be granted? So the one that is not is Democracy Now. The British want to maintain control over Palestine because they feel they need that territory in the soon-to-be world war, that the territory is an important strategic spot on the world, the crossroads of Africa and Asia. So democracy now isn't going to happen. Of the other two issues, land sales and immigration, well, if you give in to the Arab pressure, so be it. The Jews will be upset, but what are they going to do about it? Nothing. At best, the Jews could do illegal immigration, which they will, and thousands of Jews will sneak into the country illegally. And when they get into the country, what do they say? Ani Yehudi Meretz Yisrael. Even if you don't speak Hebrew, you know four words. Ani Yehudi Meretz Yisrael, and you're in the clear. So you cross the Rio Grande, you get in the country, and you're good. You say those four words, they can't stop you.
But the British can't stop you.
The British don't know who's who. So if you just say I'm a Jew from Israel, they don't know who you are. But if they see you walking in, then they'll arrest you, send you off to wherever. Later on, it would be Cyprus, but earlier on, it was just been back to Europe. Well, closing off the gates of Palestine to the Jews is not something that the British can do lightly. They have to make a real serious decision: to what extent will Jewish immigration be allowed, and to what extent will it be curtailed, delicately balancing the need to placate the Arabs, but also the need to give the Jews something to work with, that they're not totally antagonized and maybe rebel against the British rule. So, in May of 39, you have the white paper issued by Malcolm MacDonald. This paper, the MacDonald White Paper, is seen in the history of our people as a very, very dark day, a very, very sad day. Because, in hindsight, it meant the death of many people. That closing off of the gates of Palestine to the Jews means that there is no longer an outlet for the potential victims of the Shoah. And whoever could have been saved was not saved. They died. In the moment, was that something that the Jews recognized was likely to happen? So, yes. Although the war would not begin until September 1st, already in May of 39, the thinking man on the street, the Jew with an awareness of what's going on in the world, recognizes that sealing off one of the last few safe havens is likely to result in significant death. All right. So, what were the terms of the white paper? The terms of the white paper were that there shall be immigration for the next 5 years. 15,000 Jews will be allowed into the country every year between 1939 and 1944. 15,000, it's not very many. It's nothing. It's nothing. It's considerably less than the rate had been throughout the 1930s, much less than what had been throughout the 1930s. And that after 1944, all further immigration would be subject to Arab approval, which means non-existent.
Yeah.
Non-existent. So 75,000 slots, and that's pretty much it. Moreover, illegal immigration would be counted against the certificates. So anyone who got caught would now be counted not as an illegal one, but as legal, taking away somebody else's spot.
Right.
So you wouldn't have 75 plus the illegal, you'd have 75 including the illegal. All right. But also, and more importantly maybe, there was a political horizon for democracy in the country and for the end of the British administration. That there would be a 10-year window in which institutions of state would be slowly handed off to the local population, after which time the British would be gone completely. And there would be a state in Palestine, ruled by whom? By the collective body of the citizenry, which would be predominantly Arab, and therefore be an Arab state, not a Jewish state.
How could they do that?
The answer is because no one's going to stop them. The Jews could cry foul and to submit grievances to the League of Nations, which had issued the mandate for Palestine, but the League of Nations was a defunct organization by late 1939. And certainly when the war breaks out, nothing matters. No diplomacy matters at that point. War is hell. So there's little the Jews can do. The memorable scene in protesting the white paper was Chief Rabbi Herzog, who famously tore the paper in half, went like this, tore it in half, And
was he already the chief rabbi in Palestine?
He was the chief rabbi in Palestine as of 1936, yes. So he tore the paper. And who learned from his example?
Pelosi.
No, his son, Chaim Herzog, at the UN. Zionism is racism. He tore it in half. He learned from his father, from his Abba. Okay, so 1975. Well, this is a big problem for the Zionist movement. How do they deal with no longer having the cooperation in the Jewish National Project of the British Empire? For 22 years, despite its ups and downs, the British mandate had been basically a good thing. And now, a disaster. A disaster.
The United States have any say in any of this?
Not really.
Any comment on it?
Not really. No.
That was a problem.
So, the United States was not heavily involved in the affairs in Eretz Yisrael really from 1918 until after World War II.
Truman.
That in 1945, the United States, the Truman administration, becomes an important power broker in dealing with Ernest Bevin and trying to get 100,000 Jews into Palestine from the DP camps. And so America throws its weight around. But basically, from the time that America approved the Balfour Declaration under Woodrow Wilson up until the end of World War II, America doesn't play any significant role in this whole mess.
Okay. Except changing the quotas.
Well, except for changing their own immigration laws here that have an impact upon the Jews of Europe who then want to go have to go elsewhere. Right. But in terms of actually using diplomatic pressure or diplomatic capital in tinkering with the affairs of Palestine, right, America's a non-factor throughout the 20s and 30s into the early 40s.
It comes,
inevitably, because England could not sustain her empire,
right,
in 1947.
That is correct. That is correct. America is the world superpower and England is not anymore. Okay. So, with the white paper in place, the question becomes the extent of cooperation with the British government going forward. The Jewish Agency had long prided itself on acting within the law, always within the law. That the law might not always be the way we like it. It may have a bias against Zionism in certain respects, but you always play by their rules, because after all, they're in control. And the Jewish Agency was founded as an instrumentality of the mandate, so you got to play by the mandate's rules. Will that continue?
No.
So, vis-a-vis immigration and illegal immigration, the answer is sort of, in the sense that illegal immigration will be carried out by entities other than the Jewish Agency.
Aliyah Bet?
So, okay, but it wasn't carried out by the Jewish Agency. It gets carried out by the Haganah, or by the revisionist groups, but not by the people who are paid employees of the agency, the Sochnut, which is an instrumentality of the mandate. So you work around the problem by having the Histadrut, the Haganah, the Irgun and the Lehi take care of all the other activities that are illegal, and the Sochnut remains clean. This would remain that way until 1945, when the United Hebrew Resistance is formed. Okay, so Ben-Gurion famously has his statement that we're going to fight the British like there's no war, and we're going to fight the war like there's no white paper. Meaning that there's a real enemy out there, Nazism, and the fascist side of World War II is the enemy of the Jewish people, enemy of the Jewish people, and we have to fight our hardest to participate in the struggle against Nazism and win. But that doesn't mean that we can't try to undo the British white paper and undo it by whatever means possible, even under the radar and underground and illegal methods. Okay? So this is a delicate act to try to carry out. You're walking a tightrope of not offending the regime too badly, but also acting against its dictates. From a perspective of the war, so Jews want to participate in the fight against Hitler.
Right.
And how can they do that?
By joining in the army.
By joining in the army.
Right.
Or they can choose not to join in the army and protect Eretz Yisrael. So, what are the various options? One is, you enlist in the British Army, the British Navy, whatever it is. And the advantages are, number one, you get to see combat, and you get to fight the good fight against the true enemy of Nazi Germany. Also, you get military training, which in the long run will serve you in good stead, because Israel will be born in fire and bloodshed, and there will have to be a Jewish army that fights a war of independence, and you'll have your readiness and your preparedness drilled into you by your years of service in a British uniform. That is one option. Another option is the paramilitary organizations of Eretz Yisrael, the Haganah, or the Irgun and later the Lehi. In the case of the Haganah, the subgroup of the Haganah becomes the Palmach, and the Palmach is established by the British themselves in order to prevent a possible attack by Germany on Palestine, which in a few weeks we'll get to when we discuss the course of the war. But the Palmach was mostly kibbutzniks, but they were put together as a unit by the British with the goal of having sabotage acts in case the British positions are overrun in Egypt and in Palestine. So here you have Jews fighting as a Jewish unit doing potentially the bidding of the British. So you're serving your cause and the cause more broadly of the side of good in the war. Or just don't enlist in anything. Ride out the war. It's not your fight. Is that a reasonable attitude? Well, for some people it is. After all, no one is forcing you to enlist. There's no conscription. If you don't want to fight, you don't fight. And plenty of Jews ended up riding out World War II in Eretz Yisrael as though there was no war at all. The safest place on earth was Eretz Yisrael. There was no fighting. Okay. But there's conscription. You get drafted, you get drafted. There's no fighting on the soil of the United States, but you couldn't escape the war. If you were drafted, you'd go to war. You know. So we'll talk about that maybe next week. Otherwise, it would have been bad. It would have been bad. Okay. Now, in the few minutes.
You didn't mention the role of oil.
Okay. So the importance of oil should not be ignored. That one of the main reasons for the white paper was the need to secure the oil fields of the Middle East, especially in Iraq. And the thinking was, and this is an important point, that much of the Arab world was pro-Nazi, instinctively pro-Nazi.
Why?
The Nazis don't like the Jews.
All right.
And
the Mufti was beating the drums internally.
And the Mufti was beating the drums in favor of Hitlerism, but also, yeah.
An example for nationalism that could be implemented.
That's true. That's true. So the Arab on the street from the mid-30s onward was basically fascist. There were very few leftists among the Arabs. There would be later on, but not too many. Basically, the Arab world was a fascist world, and they liked Mussolini. They loved Mussolini. They liked Hitler. And the possibility of overthrowing or ejecting British forces from the Middle East in the context of a war between Germany and England was something that very much appealed to the Arab on the street, and is what almost happened in Iraq and in other places. But the British can't afford that. They can't afford to lose control over the oil fields. So what's the best way to placate the Arab population and get them to not support the Nazi side in World War II? Well, to do something bad to the Jews. So the white paper serves many purposes beyond just the immediate realm of Palestine. It keeps the Arab world happy and potentially away from an alliance with the Reich. Okay, so in September of 1930, in August of 1939, many things are happening in August of 39. On August 23rd, you have the signing of the Molotov and Ribbentrop deal, which was to split up Poland and would go into effect a week later. When this happened, it was a foregone conclusion that there would be war. And it occurred during the 21st Zionist Congress, which was taking place in Switzerland. And news of the signing of this agreement reached the dais by messenger to the Zionist Congress. And there's a very famous photograph of Chaim Weizmann, David Ben-Gurion, and Moshe Sharet sitting at a table going like this. Oi! Like the world just came to an end, because it did. And they recognized that it was now too late to save European Jewry from destruction. At best, the delegates to that conference would save themselves. And by the way, a third died in the Shoah. So although they were in neutral Switzerland, when the Congress is over, they go back home. Where is home? Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia, France, whatever it is. And those who went to countries eventually occupied by Germany, many of these people did not live to survive the war. What would the Zionist movement do during World War II as the war is about to break out? What is the fate of the movement? Now remember, during World War I, what happened to the movement? So it was bifurcated because there were people on both sides. Each side very much interested in their side winning. So it was Jew versus Jew, not necessarily, on the battlefield, yes, you had Jew versus Jew, but in the political realm of Zionism, you had German Zionists who wanted Germany to win, you had British Zionists who wanted England to win. With World War II, there's no two sides. There's only one side. But the problem is that the center of gravity of Zionism, which had been Europe, is going to be devastated. And so where will the focus of Zionism be once war breaks out? America. 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 So British Zionism is basically going to be marginalized and no longer all that relevant. Eretz Yisrael is relevant because there are a half a million Jews living there. Or 450,000 Jews. So the Yishuv matters because these are where the real Zionists live and they are in a life and death struggle against the Arabs. But the locus of Zionism will be shifted to New York. But not just New York, also Washington, D.C. Because the American government will play a role, or not choose to play a role, in the saving of Jews. And who are the ringleaders in terms of the saving of Jews during the war? So for the most part, Zionists. To a lesser extent, but not to minimize it at all, the rabbis, the Orthodox rabbis. Varatzala. But Zionism, American Zionism, will be at the center of the action. Okay. When the war breaks out, where are the key players? So, Ben-Gurion is in Israel. Jabotinsky is in America. He's in New York. Weizmann will be bouncing back and forth between England and Israel. And as for the others, the Yishuv leaders are in Israel. Menachem Ussishkin, who dies a year later, is in Israel. Most of the players are in Israel. Who's in America? Stephen Wise. Louis Lipsky. And some other names who might not be so familiar to you. Who's in Europe? Plenty of the great Zionist leaders of the 20s and 30s were in Europe, in Poland. And what happens to them? Most of them don't make it out of the war alive. Most are killed in the Shoah. Who's going to survive from Polish Jewry among the Zionist leadership? So the one name that comes to mind is Yitzhak Grunbaum, who becomes a minister in the first government of Israel. But there are Zionists all over the world, and yet each one is going to have to suffer his own fate, with those on continental Europe not being in a good position. All right, last point for tonight. What does the Yishuv think at the level of the rank and file, the average Jew in the Yishuv? What does he think about the role of Palestine Jewry in the war that's about to begin, the Great War, for the fate of the world is at stake? What does the average Jew in Eretz Yisrael think to himself about what's going to happen? So, are they concerned about the affairs abroad or not?
Yes and no.
Yes and no. You're right. For some, the diaspora had been so negated that the focus was only on Eretz Yisrael. And although no one wants their brethren, their cousins left behind in Europe to suffer a genocide, the focus was our existence here and our eventual independence. Alternatively, there's a school of thought that says, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeh Bazeh, we're all Am Yisrael Chai, and we have to be concerned for our brethren anywhere they might be.
Well, didn't they enlist in the British Army?
Yes, so that school of thought says, let's enlist. But within the approach that is Palestino-centric and is not focused on elsewhere in the world, what would be the approach towards the outside Jewish world by such Palestinian Zionist Jews between 39 and 40, 41, 42? What is their thinking?
Why don't they fight back?
Okay, that's one element of it. Just as we fight, they should fight over there too, but something else. And that is, we want to save people so they can come here. We don't want to save people just for the sake of saving people. We want to save people for the sake of them being here, because we need more people here. And so rescue attempts and the whole notion of Hatzalah, of rescue, is not geared towards the life of the individual Jew in the Chutz La'aretz, but rather the Jew as Chomer Enoshi, human material, for the building up of the Yishuv. Okay, so from a Zionist point of view, that's an advantage, not a disadvantage.
We'll take you.
Nobody else will take you, we'll take you. And good, because better you should go here than anywhere else. Does this attitude actually end up mattering at all in the lives of people? Is it as though other places of refuge were intentionally rejected or spurned? I don't think so. But it's always good to keep in mind that if there are rescue attempts done by the Jews of Eretz Yisrael on behalf of brethren abroad, the goal is to get them to a specific place, namely Eretz Yisrael. Yeah.
Was there a breakdown demographically as to who were the more ambivalent versus who were the more caring about the Chutz-Lars in terms of either right-wing, left-wing, or, for example...
religious and secular?
Religious, non-religious, or the most recent Aliyah where they were mainly German Jews,
right,
versus the people who had been there for many years.
Okay, good. So the answer is that those with immediate family abroad, of course, care about their immediate family. The religious, especially the clergy, tend to have a bigger picture view of things and want to save as many nefashot as possible. That's the traditionally Jewish point of view. Those who are not guided by religious scruples, but were guided primarily by nationalism, might have become more indifferent to those who were their kinsmen, so to speak, abroad. This is especially the case for the far extreme. I won't even use the word right or left, but for the Canaanite group. For the Canaanite group, they see themselves as indigenous to the land of Canaan, the land of Israel, and they want to have nothing to do with the Jews of abroad. Now, that's ridiculous, because you just got off the boat a minute ago and all of a sudden you're a Canaanite. Okay, but that attitude did exist among some extreme Jews. but it's hard to say, it's hard to divide it along political lines. Suffice it to say that the mainstream political parties, if you exclude, let's say, the communists or those like in the Birionim crowd, if you put those aside, everyone in the middle expressed concern for the well-being of diaspora Jewry and would have preferred to save as many as possible, but with the caveat that they should go to Israel. Okay, yeah.
The blue part